Television is exploding, and it's time to celebrate. The Emmys are this weekend, and we've got a lot of nominees, like Patricia Arquette, who could grab two awards on Sunday night.
Well, it's very weird because I didn't see this coming, but I feel like I'm getting the best parts of my life, and I'm 51.
And Julia Louis-Dreyfus, her political satire Veep has ended, but it did leave us with some strange bedfellows.
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan once told me that she got together with Justice Scalia when Veep was on the air because they were both fans. Imagine that.
And the limited series category is really strong this year. We talk with the creators of When They See Us and Chernobyl. I'm John Horn. Joining me is Lorraine Ali, the TV critic for the LA Times. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC in Los Angeles, it's the Frame Emmy Special. We'll be right back.
If you want to have fun, come on with me. You can stay all night and play with my TV. TV is the thing that's here.
Welcome to the Frame Emmy Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame.
And I'm Lorraine Ali, television critic for the LA Times. Today we'll hear from a lot of nominees about their work and their shows, and we'll talk about what Emmys can tell us about the state of television right now, which is a really, really interesting state.
Yeah, and one thing I want to talk about is late-night talk shows. I mean, I know we think that that's a place to go for humor and some jokes. I'm finding, like, some of the best documentary reporting on television right now is happening on shows like John Oliver and Samantha Bee, so we'll cover that.
I am really looking forward to the limited series category this year because it is the best stuff that has been on television. You're talking about Chernobyl, When They See Us, Fosse Verdon, Escape in Dannemora. These are all excellent shows. And the limited series category used to be kind of like, meh. Now, it's like that is the place that we're looking at, and I'm looking forward to see what happens with that.
But we're going to start with a comedy series, and that is Veep, and its lead actress could make some Emmy history.
And the Emmy goes to Julia Louis-Dreyfus for Veep.
And the Emmy goes to
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
What? Julia Louis-Dreyfus now holds the record for most Emmys won by a performer in the same role for the same series. This is amazing.
Veep just came back for its final season. There was another big final season. It rhymes with Game of Thrones. It is Game of Thrones. That one is gone. But before Veep wrapped up its final season, I had a chance to speak with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
There's a lot of grief around the end of a series, assuming the series has been a good thing and a happy thing, which in our case it has been. And that has an incredible bittersweetness to it that can really gut you. And it did.
Let's talk about the final season.
Sure.
Selena's running for president.
Yeah.
And she is asked a basic question very early in this season, which is why. And other people are curious, but here's a conversation that she has with Gary, who's played by Tony Hale.
Because it is my god turn. I was the game changer.
Yep.
I took a on the glass ceiling and I shaved my in the sink of the old boys' club. But for 3 years, Hughes kept me chained to a radiator in some basement in Cleveland. So as far as I'm concerned, America owes me an 8-year stay in the White House, and this time I want a war.
Yes.
What is it like listening to that?
It's gobs of fun. I think that's so well written. So I was just sort of listening to the language. You know, she's not a great candidate.
That's an understatement.
But I appreciate her bitterness and her struggle.
When you are playing her, do you have some way of saying, okay, I know that this is a character, and I know that what she wants is not something that she's able to express, but as the actor playing her, I have to believe what it is she wants?
Here's how I would answer that. She's a very horrible human being and hideously behaved and really has no leadership skills whatsoever or no point of view even other than her own narcissistic endeavor. But when you play her, you have to come at it from, well, why? And once you start to humanize that horribleness, you can find a way in to play it with a certain amount of Well, in a weird way, I have to say empathy.
Right.
And even though I'm not necessarily asking the viewer to be empathetic, I just want the viewer to laugh. But it just, perhaps that keeps her from being hated by the audience.
Right. What are the greater kinds of compliments you can get from people who work in politics?
I hear time and time again, this is what it's really like in Washington. And, you know, I wince as I say that to you. But yeah, that's what we hear. I had the great good fortune to meet Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan once. And she told me that she got together with Justice Scalia when Veep was on the air every week to discuss the past week's episode because they were both fans. Imagine that.
I can't.
I know. I would do anything to have heard those conversations.
Let's hope somebody recorded them.
I know. Maybe the FBI.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus is up for lead actress in a comedy series for Veep. Spoiler, she's going to win. You're listening to the Frame Emmy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, here with Lorraine Ali, the TV critic for the LA Times. Lorraine, as far as show endings for the year goes, how would you rate the end of Veep?
The end of Veep was one of the best finales on a long-running series I have seen in a long time. And I think it gave it a kind of closure for the show and also an idea that maybe there's an end in sight for what we're going through now.
Another show that isn't going away but came back, and I have to say, a lot better than when it left us, is True Detective. Its third season had Mahershala Ali. When True Detective first came Mahershala Ali's way, he was actually up for a supporting part, but he thought he should play the lead and took his idea to the creator, Nick Pizzolatto.
Speaking to Nick, I had basically shared, like, look, I think that this other part, this Roland part, is a great part. But in my own way, I feel like I've been doing that for a long time, where I've kind of been in support of the story and not having an opportunity to carry it. And so I had a conversation about my grandfather, who was a California State Police officer. And I got some pictures from a cousin, and I texted them or emailed them to Nick. And he obviously believed that we existed in that space. Otherwise, Roland wouldn't have been black, you know. But I felt like I needed to send that to say, listen, I can do this. And this is my own personal experience with this. And I think that that impacted him. And he didn't feel like race was going to be the centerpiece of the story, which I was excited about because I don't feel like every time a story of ours pops up, race needs to be the central point or the driving force behind the story. Like, it's just in our bones as well. It's just we experience life as people who happen to be black, but it's not always about something racial, but we definitely have a real perspective and experience and see the world through our own eyes because of being an African American. And so we found that we were very much in alignment.
I want to play a scene from the first episode where you were talking to a school teacher played by Carmen Ejogo, with whom your characters will spend a little more time down the road.
Yes.
But I think this is a really telling definition of what you were just talking about.
How is it here? You know.
It's fine. It's good, really, for what it is. I hear something now and then. They're all poor around here, that's the main thing.
What you hear now and then?
You know, a word in the hallway or something. They're careful around me.
I love that line your character has. How is it here, you know?
Yeah.
They know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet it's not the story, but it's the circumstance.
Right. And that is so much closer to at least the folks that I've been around in life communicate, especially when you're being private and public, so to speak. And there's just an understanding. Obviously, stories about race and racism and definitely have their place and their purpose and are extraordinarily valuable. But when you also have space for that to not be the driving force, it allows you to get to know black people, black culture on a deeper level as well, because you're just spending time with them talking about different things.
That was was Mahershala Ali, and he's nominated for lead actor in a limited series, and that's for True Detective.
The Primetime Emmys are coming this Sunday night, September 22nd, but this past weekend, the TV Academy gave out the Creative Arts Emmys over two nights. The winner of Outstanding Structured Reality Show was Queer Eye, and that beat out Marie Kondo's Tidying Up. She didn't get the trophy, but I think she had a little bit of an impact. Have you done a Kondo in your life?
She may have had an impact on culture at large, but apparently not in our house. I'm not even going to say apparently. She did not have an impact in our house. I would say our house looks more like Stranger Things after the Mind Flayer just completely decimated Hawkins. That's our house. But yeah, no, I know. She had a large impact outside of our home.
You may not be alone. There is at least one other skeptic I know of. That is Frame contributor Colin Friesen and his wife, Stephanie Chekhovsky. They agreed to give the Kondo method a shot to see if it's as simple as it looks on TV. Apparently not.
Hello, I'm Marie Kondo. My mission is...
At only eight episodes, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, the tiny, super chipper Japanese neatness expert who's convinced the world that we have too much stuff and are folding bras the wrong way, is very bingeable, meaning you can learn the right way to declutter a spice rack in just hours, even less if you skip over just the parts where she says hi, which feels like about half of every show. But while I was skeptical of condoing our apartment, my wife could hardly wait.
This totally appeals to me because, like, you know my stepfather, he's basically a hoarder. And my grandmother is a complete neatnik. So, I mean, I think we do a good job, but we are nowhere near Marie condoing.
Step one was to present our home with our intentionality for what we wanted it to become, or something. To do this, we had to literally kneel on the carpet.
Oh, God, I can't do this. I can't.
If kneeling is the hardest part of this experience, we're in a lot of trouble.
What we're doing is we have to set an intention for the house, right?
Right. So shut your eyes and set an intention for the house.
You are super spiritual. I'm so glad I married you.
Then the real work began.
Door number one.
You don't tackle one room, then the next in this system. Everything gets discarded by category.
Can we do them in portion?
No, you do all the clothes at once.
Oh, God. I'm already kind of organized. It's going to ruin any organization I already have.
That's not the Marie Kondo spirit, lady.
All right, fine.
The rule is you make a pile of all your stuff, then hold each item. I think you can double up on socks. But you hold each shirt or jacket or pair of pants and decide if it sparks joy in you.
It's a pink kind of athletic. It almost looks like a Letterman jacket.
Does it spark joy?
Can I say it's halfway joyous? Like, it doesn't get...
Yeah, then you can keep half of it.
Now, this will likely take you some time, because if you're anything like us, you have way too much stuff.
I've got eight hoodies here.
Yeah.
Most of which purchased by you for me. Which ones do I get rid of?
Well, some of those are a pullover hoodie.
That one I will donate.
Does it not spark joy? I love that one.
They all spark joy.
We remove five full garbage bags from our bedroom, but I will admit, it looked better once we rehung the remaining wardrobe. Or is that joydrobe? Anyway, next up was the books, which you first have to wake up by tapping them. And then you do the does holding them spark joy thing again. Now, for the sake of your pride, I would not recommend doing this for a public radio audience.
First one is?
Drop Dead Beautiful, a novel by Jackie Collins. I know it's embarrassing. It is a guilty, guilty pleasure, but it sparks utter joy.
Next up was paper.
God, so much paper.
And the Marie Kondo method is a great excuse to get rid of that vacuum cleaner manual you've kept in case someday you forget how a vacuum cleaner works.
I don't think this is a good way for couples to bond, frankly, because I think a normal couple would just eventually tear each other's throats out.
Then it was on to kimono, which means purging miscellaneous stuff like kitchenware. And it was during this phase that I realized just how random our acquisitions can be.
Look at how many rice scoops we have.
Only four.
Five. Six, seven.
Wow, that's a lot of rice scoops.
So we thanked six of the seven rice scoops and packed them up for donation. And finally, you do mementos, which kind of screwed us up because some of our most prized possessions were books and clothes. But like they say, the program only works if you work it. Now, on the show, it takes weeks and weeks to run through a total cleanse. We knocked it out in about 4 days, but that's likely because we skipped out on refolding all our clothes in the proper Marie Kondo way, because, frankly, a person can only be pushed so far.
Is it in sideways?
It won't. You gotta put stuff in it.
Then it was time to drag our stuff to the nearest out of the closet. And so, sitting in the parking lot, we took a moment to reflect on what we had just done.
I think the reason they end up getting rid of so much stuff is because it is such a tedious process. Midway through holding up another t-shirt, people are just like, screw it, get rid of it.
Yeah.
And that's how they actually end up cleaning their houses.
Because there was a point where I'm just like, I just don't want to see anything else. I just don't want to pick it up. There is a palpable difference in how you feel. I've noticed that it, you know, it affects how I, at least over the last couple of days, how I'm kind of seeing the world a little bit.
How badly do you want to go inside this out of the closet and shop right now?
I don't actually. Like,
wow.
There is.
We may have cured you of your thrift store addiction.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm in a thrift store addiction.
Well, let's go before you relapse.
Don't paint me that way, dude.
The Marie Kondo method. Good for your home, maybe not great for your marriage.
For the frame, I'm Stephanie Chukowski.
What? I did most of it.
That was produced by Frame contributor Colin Friesen. A little later, he's going to take another dive into reality TV.
Coming up, we have Ava DuVernay, John Leguizamo, Patricia Arquette, Ben Stiller, and Michelle Williams.
That is next on the Frame Emmy special from KPCC in Los Angeles.
Welcome back to the Frame Emmy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Lorraine Olley, television critic for the Los Angeles Times.
And I'm John Horn, host of the Frame. And this year, Lorraine, the limited series category has some really heavy hitters.
Slouch. I don't think I've ever heard that word from a choreographer before.
There was nothing sane about Chernobyl.
Your son was involved in rape in Central Park.
Did you have sex with these two inmates?
No.
And I'm wondering, as a TV critic, what do you make of this category? And how do you evaluate them compared to, say, a drama series or a movie?
I think it's, you know, when you're trying to compare limited series to, you know, ongoing dramas, it's kind of like apples and oranges. But what's interesting about limited series is a lot of these in here, Chernobyl, When They See Us, Fosse Verdon, are based on real stories. And it's kind of telling you the things that maybe we want to see now. Chernobyl dealing with a secretive government, When They See Us dealing with, you know, institutional racism. So that's what we're picking for entertainment right now.
No, I think you're really onto something here, because I think what's important about these limited series is not just that they're based on true events, but that even if they're events that happened decades ago, they are still, if not remarkably, relevant today.
And even Escape in Dannemora, sure, was a prison break, but when you look at what they're looking at there, it's the media coverage. It's how distorted all of that was. And we can certainly relate to that now, can't we?
Yeah, definitely. And about mass incarceration and
right.
People who are locked up. And I want to talk a little bit more about When They See Us. It's a Netflix limited series. It's about the five young men who were forced to confess to a crime that they didn't commit, and that was the rape of a woman in Central Park. The series was created and directed by Ava DuVernay.
We're here to see Ava.
First and last name, sir.
John Horn. Okay.
And I had a chance to visit with her at Array, which is the name of her production company.
Are we recording? Are we on?
We are.
It started?
It has started.
Okay.
It's going. Your series is called When They See Us, and there's so much about that title. It could describe this series. It could describe what drives you. It could describe the void that a lot of people like you are trying to fill. What does the title mean to you? Why did you apply it? And what do you think it means?
Gosh, I liked all those meanings. Thank you. For me, it was really about a title that was about more than just Central Park 5. That was the working title for a long time. I felt that it was, you know, I became allergic to it. It had no meaning. It had no emotion to it. It felt really just like a moniker that had been given to these men by a lazy press corps at the time, by, you know, political entities and the police. And inherent in the title is a them and an us, right? And who is the they and who is the us? So it is really kind of calling attention to the divide. And then, you know, the behavior that's put on the divide, a shaping that's always done, a review, an analysis of us based on how we look and not on who we are. And so all of that, a lot of what I've studied about Dr. King is also embedded in that title, that, you know, when I look at you walking down the street, John Horn is a debonair kind of guy, but you, I would look, see you and assume, oh, upstanding gentleman and law-abiding citizen. You look like that type. You could be anything, but you, the way you look has come to mean safe and okay, right? And the way that I look and my friends and some of my friends that I was with last night would mean just the opposite for someone if you're looking up in the dictionary. So this whole idea of optics and who we really are and humanity, all of that's embedded in the title. And, you know, you got to get to the end of it to maybe understand it. That's why John Horn knows what the title means, because he watched it.
All the way to the end.
To the end.
Ava, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say, this was a very hard thing to watch. It is such a miscarriage of justice. And to see these young boys all alone being bullied and beaten by the police, it was harrowing. It was like a horror movie for me. And I told Ava, it was really hard to get through. I got through it, but it felt like I needed to watch it, as difficult as it was to watch.
It was difficult to watch, and I think that's the whole challenge, right? The whole idea is, if you are coming from any other perspective, if you are not a young Black man, you need to see what these young men were facing. And I think the idea is to bring you into this. And, you know, the performances are so strong in it. I won a Creative Arts Emmy already for the casting. In the supporting actor in a limited series category, 3 of the 6 nominees are all from When They See Us.
Yeah, and that includes John Leguizamo. He plays Raymond Santana Sr., who's the father of one of the boys who was wrongfully sent to jail.
The beauty of When They See Us, done by Ava DuVernay, is that it brings you there. It makes you present. It makes you be one of the kids. It makes you be one of the parents, which nothing else could have done that. I mean, not all the news articles written about it, not the beautiful documentary by Ken Burns, which was one of the most masterful documentaries. I mean, because it really gave you the legality of it. But it didn't make you one of the kids or the parents like the series does. And even when I was reading the script, it was so painful. I would rehearse with my wife and she would read the other part. She would weep so much. I go, if you cried through the whole time, I can't rehearse with you because I can't understand what you're saying. That's how painful it was.
I want to ask you about the real Raymond Santana Jr. There are these portraits of the Central Park Five at the end of the series, and they are very impressive looking men. And I'm wondering, was it intentional to have any kind of contact with the real characters? Were you able to meet with them, or did you want to keep your distance?
Well, I've been method my whole life, you know, and method is, you know, you got to meet the people, you got to do research, you got to involve yourself. So, you know, I met Santana Sr. and I met Raymond Jr. and we went to dinner together. I took him to a really fancy restaurant. I felt that was the least I could do. And I just asked and talked and wanted to understand what were the thought processes that allowed Mr. Santana to sign that confession, and how did you live with that, you know? And the poor man, you know, he was a single dad. The mom was ill, and they were separated. The mom was ill. And he had a lot of responsibilities, and he, you know, he was afraid of losing his job, and he just thought that his son's innocence would come to light someday. And I think the takeaway is, don't confess to anything you didn't do. Don't sign anything. And just ask for a lawyer. I mean, that's the takeaway that I walked away from that.
That was John Leguizamo. He's nominated for the Emmy for Supporting Actor in a Limited Series for his work in When They See Us.
You're listening to the Frame Emmy Special. I'm Lorraine Olley, television critic for the Los Angeles Times. And I'm here with John Horn, host of the Frame on KPCC in Los Angeles. So I think it's time to talk about Chernobyl. It's about the meltdown of the nuclear reactor in the 1980s.
means the fire we're watching with our own eyes is giving off nearly twice the radiation released by the bomb in Hiroshima.
But what it's really looking at is how damaging misinformation and secrecy from the government can be, and it's certainly something that we can relate to now. I was thinking, why would I want to watch this at this point? Really, within the first 20 minutes of the first episode, I was like, oh, I know why I want to watch this. This means something to me right now.
Yeah, and even though it's about the former Soviet Union, it could be any country right now. And my entry into the series was weird. My oldest son was watching it. My dad was talking about it. Then a friend said, my buddy Craig Mazin wrote it. You should check it out. So I checked it out, and it is amazing. So Craig Mazin, who mostly had done like big budget studio comedies like The Hangover, is the creator, and he wrote every episode, and we had him into the frame to talk about making Chernobyl.
For me, the entire Chernobyl process began with stumbling over a simple fact. No one knows how Chernobyl blew up, essentially. They know it blew up, but they don't know how. And when I was starting just to fill in that small gap of knowledge, the fact that I stumbled over was that on the night of the accident, they were running a safety test. And that is the kind of thing, as a writer...
That's gold.
You know, it's gold because the irony is already baked in. What I didn't expect was that those kinds of things would keep coming. And there are so many of them, and I just felt compelled to share them with everybody.
I want to play some audio from the first episode. It's one of the only things in the entire series that's not in English, and it's the Russian equivalent of a 911 call to the firefighters. You focus on a number of people, like firefighters. How do you figure out the people that you want to nominate to have active roles as protagonists in the story, and what kind of truth you have and how much fiction you bring to their lives?
I wanted to show this tragedy from many different altitudes, because the nature of the tragedy at the highest level, say in the Kremlin, is disturbing and distressing and upsetting. But it's an entirely different experience on the ground when you're just trying to keep your husband alive. There are many aspects to the truth. It is not simple. You can't nail it down. And I wanted people to see it from all those levels so that they could feel how this permeated everything in the Soviet Union.
Craig Mazin's Chernobyl is up for Outstanding Limited Series. For the next one, Lorraine, I have to thank you for turning me on to this, because this was like, this is my favorite show going on right now. Escape at Dannemora, or Escape at Dannemora, Escape at Dannemora, however it's pronounced.
Dannemora.
You got it. Tell me about why you were so smitten with this show.
Oh, well, I'm so happy that I pushed this show on you, and you like it. What is so great about this, the cast, Benicio del Toro, Paul Dano, Patricia Arquette, together, they play off each other in a way that you can imagine the true life characters did. Because these two men are kind of manipulating this woman who works in the prison to kind of help them get out.
My husband never looks at me.
Baby.
But on the other hand, she's getting something from them that she doesn't have in her life, which is excitement, which is the possibility of breaking out of this really, really sad town and this like jail she's working in. And I just thought the performances were fantastic. Benicio del Toro scared me. He scared me. He was so good. Paul Dano is such a great sort of grounding force in there, but he's also a criminal. So he plays all of that really well. I'm glad you liked it.
No, and the oddest thing about it is that it was directed by Ben Stiller. You think of him as doing Zoolander, Tropic Thunder, kind of not really weighty stuff as an actor and as a filmmaker. It's not only well directed, but it's also not judgmental. These are people you could easily label white trash or, you know, ignorant criminal, and yet this series is not interested in that. And I think that's almost the greatest strength about Escape at Dannemora. And director Ben Stiller came by to talk about his approach to making it. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, I'm happy to see you.
I want you to think back to when it actually happened.
Ballet here. We're cutting into regular programming because of last night's prison break in Dannemora. Governor Andrew Cuomo has arrived in the North Country and is at the prison right now. These two inmates have been identified as 48-year-old Richard Matt, 34-year-old David Sweat.
These are two dangerous individuals.
Do you have a specific recollection of hearing about the escape, or did it come to you later?
I was actually in Italy filming Zoolander 2 when it happened.
It wasn't really in the headlines.
Yeah, it was, you know, I heard a little bit something about it, but when I came back, it was when they sent me the script. Michael Tolkien and Brett Johnson sent me the script that they had written a few months after it happened. That's when I really first heard about it.
So in June of 2016, Catherine Leigh Scott, the Inspector General for the State of New York, releases this report. And it reads like a novel. It is like a Michael Connelly novel. I mean, some great crime writer. It's unbelievable. And it's got so many great little details in it. So when this comes out, does this change your thinking? Does it change the whole nature of the script?
Yeah, well, it actually was the reason that I came back and said I wanted to do it when it came out. Because that was, at that point, I'd said, I don't think I can do it because I don't know how to make this up. I didn't feel confident enough in doing that. So then when the report came out, I immediately emailed with Brett and Michael because they saw it too. It was in the New York Times. It just came out. You could just click on the PDF. And it was just, you know, fascinating. And it was so detail-oriented that I thought, okay, this is the source material. And if we want to start from scratch with all these real details, which are much more interesting than anyone could make up, then let's do it.
Probably the most loaded category in the Emmys, Best Actress in a Limited Series or a TV Movie. Patricia Arquette is nominated in this category for Escape at Dahnemora. We also had a chance to talk with Patricia Arquette about making the series.
With this character, I had to gain a lot of weight. Her jaw was kind of different, so I'm wearing prosthetic teeth, these giant contact lenses. And then her clothing, it's sort of this throwaway American consumer clothing where with perpetual youth kind of, and she's kind of displaying her breasts more, maybe provocatively more than she should in her workplace, because I think she wants to feel alive and sexual and beautiful in a world where she doesn't fit into this concept of what is beauty.
And it doesn't feel as if the show is judging her, that it seems very intentional that the show is not going to comment on the decisions that she makes, even though she makes some bad ones, that you are going to understand her and not write her off.
I have to say that has a lot to do with Ben Stiller's direction, because he really felt strongly about that and really supported hearing who Tilly was and seeing her story, and he didn't have a judgment of her. And also Michael Tolkien and Brett Johnson. When we would talk about her character, Brett Johnson said to me at one point, you know, I see Tilly as like the least likely femme fatale. But they were fascinated by Tilly, and so was I. When I was watching the news and it was starting to happen and I was watching this jailbreak, suddenly they had this picture of this lady and they said, she might be connected to one of these prisoners. I was like, what? That lady? And the next day they were like, she may have had an affair with both of these prisoners. I'm like, that lady? So I just wanted to know more about Tilly.
That was Patricia Arquette. She's nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a Limited Series or TV Movie for Escape at Dahnemora. She also has a supporting nomination in the same category for The Act.
It's phenomenal what she's been able to do. I mean, you know, you think of her career at this point, and it's actually in a better place than it was 10 years ago. She's over 50, and for women right now in television and in film...
Not so much in film.
Well, okay. For women right now, television is a great, great place to be. It's interesting because Patricia Arquette's also up against some women that are coming in from film, and I wouldn't say they're small names. It's Amy Adams and Michelle Williams, who's had this amazing film career, Manchester by the Sea, and here she is, you know, moving into television as well, and she's playing opposite Sam Rockwell as Bob Fosse.
Well, actually, he suggested that it might be nice if the two of you were to get together a little bit sooner. He wants to teach you some of the steps. Watch you move.
He wants to audition me.
He wants to meet you.
In order to audition me.
Fozzie Verdon is a story about a creative partnership that is very one-sided. Hint, the guy gets most of the acclaim, even though Gwen Verdon is a key collaborator with Bob Fosse. Michelle Williams is great in it, as is Sam Rockwell. And we had a chance to talk to Michelle Williams about playing Gwen Verdon in Fozzie Verdon.
Once I had signed on to the part and once I had gotten the part, the kind of deeper, more personal research that I was able to do, and to realize that in order to play this woman, I was going to have to become a bigger person.
What do you mean by that? That's an interesting idea.
she encompassed more than how I think of myself. She was more demonstrative, more comfortable in space, more outgoing, a bigger, better storyteller. Her aura, if I can say that, to me, felt bigger than mine. I was like, I was going to have to grow. And also, we play them from 30 into 64, and I've never been 64. So that was going to take a wild leap of imagination and understanding and growth. And the thing that I actually did as I was on this journey trying to figure out how am I going to make my spirit bigger to play this woman who I believe had a bigger spirit than I do, and I started meditating because I didn't know another way that I was going to fulfill the demands of this job. Also, the kind of rigors of this sort of job. I haven't done television in a long time. In a way, this is very akin to doing Broadway because of the schedule of it. It's really grueling work. And television, you're working between 16 and 18 hours a day. And on this, we danced rehearse on the weekends. So to have the kind of like stamina to endure that schedule, I needed to fill myself out. And the way that I found to do that was through meditation. It was the only way that I could create more space in my psyche.
That was Michelle Williams. She's nominated for lead actress in a limited series or movie for playing Gwen Verdon in Fosse Verdon. Coming up, more Emmy nominees, including Samantha Bee from Variety Talk. You're listening to the Frame Emmy Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. Welcome back to the Frame Emmy Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame.
And I'm Lorraine Olley, television critic for the LA Times. Let's talk about the Variety Talk category now. It's a really interesting category, and it speaks to a lot of what we've been through this year, and I feel like I've been through it with these people. I've been through it with John Oliver. I've been through it with Stephen Colbert. We're friends now.
Every day, I wake up and I think things can't possibly get any worse. And every day, Donald Trump says, hold my filet of fish. I'm going in.
That's right. Trump wants to roll back energy regulations instituted by Bush and completed by Obama, because he thinks he looks better under old light bulbs.
I'm thinking about John Oliver's Last Week Tonight. That show has won the Emmy for the last 3 years, and it's nominated again this year.
We're going to talk about medicine. You know, the thing that Doogie Howser pretended to be able to practice, leading to 92 deaths and life in prison.
I mean, if you watch John Oliver's show or Samantha Bee's show, you'll see informed reporting on some of the most pressing issues of the day. Pay in women's soccer, Sherpas in Mount Everest, medical device design.
The medical device industry is huge. They constitute a $156 billion market in the U.S., and more people have one than you might think.
Deportations were handled by the Enforcement and Removal Operations Unit, a division of the newly created ICE, which was a division of the newly created Department of Homeland Security, which was a division of, I want to say, Nabisco?
I was in New York not that long ago, and I had a chance to talk with Samantha Bee about Full Frontal.
Well, we want this show to, like, merge our two greatest passions. So we want this show to be funny. It's primarily a comedy show. But if it's not grounded in something that we care about, for me, who cares?
What does the combination of the journalism, the issues, how does comedy change the way that people react to those facts?
Well, I think that comedy can do one thing, which is make difficult issues digestible. And I don't mean it's silly, but it is a kind of a spoonful of sugar. If you can package a difficult story entertainingly, people receive it differently. I'm not a journalist. Marrying these two worlds is the only thing I really want to do with this bizarre skill set that I have worked on my entire life for no apparent reason.
The boys wanna be her, the girls wanna be her.
Full,
full, full,
frontal with Samantha Bee. Samantha Bee.
You're listening to the Frame Emmy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. We mentioned Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Veep earlier. Let's talk a little bit more about what kind of influence she has had on the comedy category.
So when you look at what's nominated for comedy and you kind of think about what the influence of Veep is, these are such non-traditional ideas. I mean, you've got Barry about a hitman.
I can't work for you anymore, all right? You got to find someone else.
Well, do you know any other assassins?
No.
Well, what do you want me to do? Go to John Wick Assassin Hotel with Help Wanted sign? I mean, what?
You've got The Good Place, which is like, I don't even know how you describe that. Philosophical existential crisis.
Set in
afterlife.
Heaven or hell.
Yeah,
or...
what is it? Right, exactly.
I choose to be good every day if there is no guaranteed reward we can count on now or in the afterlife.
And then Russian Doll, another one where it's like Groundhog Day, but not really, but super dark, and you keep dying over and over again. That's funny. It's a comedy.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I used to have the perfect life.
Ma vie était parfaite.
And then it was completely upended when my husband had an affair.
Et elle était complètement bouleversée quand mon mari a eu une histoire.
He cheated on me.
Il m'a trompé.
That's a bad thing.
Fleabag.
Oh, you look fantastic.
Oh, well, you both look gorgeous.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Is that fur?
Yes, but it's okay because it had a stroke.
Oh, lovely.
I can't go to hell for that, can I, Father?
No, not as long as you confess.
Oh, God, he's their priest.
Then you have nothing to worry about.
Their cool, sweary priest.
Fleabag, even 5 years ago, that's the kind of thing that would have been dumped on Netflix, middle of the night. You would have heard about it from a friend. You're like, oh, that's kind of cool. The fact that it's here and it's a nominee just sort of speaks to where we are at this moment. It is wide open, and some really, really cool cutting edge stuff is making its way to the top.
We talked with Shawn Clifford. She plays the sister of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is Fleabag. Phoebe Waller-Bridge created and stars in the series. And Shawn is nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
We definitely work together in quite a unique way on the set. The way that we communicate, I would say, without dialogue, actually. There's an understanding between us. But we suddenly looked at each other one day and we were like, you know, we never ever discussed how to play those characters. We just knew. And that trust that we have, because we have known each other for so long and been such close collaborators for so long, that's why, one of the reasons why she fought for me to play that role.
I want to play a clip from a scene from this current season and about Claire and Fleabag and about their kind of conflicted, messy, but in the end, I think very, very beautiful relationship.
Take this. I'll try to talk Martin down, but call him if you need him. He's a very good lawyer. Surprisingly tender underneath it all.
Knew it.
What you did in the restaurant was unforgivable.
I know.
Thank you.
I think that almost defines their relationship. What you did was unforgivable. Thank you.
I love this relationship. It feels so truthful to me. I've never seen it portrayed like this on a television screen before, or in a film, or anywhere. I've never seen it so accurately depicted. What I'm starting to realize is that all the characters sort of mention things that they might be talking about themselves, but they can relate to any number of the characters in the show. And it's actually what our dad says, played by the glorious Bill Paterson. He says, you know, that he loves Fleabag, but he doesn't know if he likes her all the time. And I think that's the same for Fleabag and Claire. Like, the love is unquestionable. It's unconditional. But they're not friends. They're sisters.
Shawn Clifford plays Claire in Fleabag. She's nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy. You're listening to the Frame Emmy special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn here with Lorraine Ali, the TV critic at the LA Times. Lorraine, it's come down to the drama category. I guess Game of Thrones is going to win. I don't know why, just to thank it for being over. But I have to say, this is a category where it feels like limited series, comedy, late night, they're doing maybe more interesting things, or I'm just not watching the right shows?
Drama is really the least interesting category this year. And part of it, I feel like, is a lot of the energy that we saw going into drama series have gone into limited series. So, I mean, we're not seeing as much creative stuff in the dramas as we are in the comedies. And a series like Better Call Saul or Ozark, that's almost like a comedy, or Killing Eve. I mean, I find it really funny. This Is Us, yeah, not so much. But Pose, for instance.
The category is...
Game of Thrones was fantasy, and that was great to escape and blah, blah, blah. But we're in a different place now, and Pose is really the world I want to see. That's what I want to see pop, and it is.
Okay, Lorraine, before we go, we have one more story. About two decades ago, the TV Academy started honoring reality shows, and now there are three subcategories: structured, unstructured, and competition reality shows. And our contributor, Colin Friesen, who tells us he's never won anything, tried to figure out how you win one of those trophies.
I lost my dignity on a slippery wiener.
We're not great friends. Let's not sugarcoat this.
The marriage of reality TV and the Emmys has always felt a little shotgun-ish. Like when someone brings a six-pack of Zima to your house party, you're never sure who exactly thought it was a good idea, but at a certain point, booze is booze.
Stop interrupting me.
Even Emmy hosts like Jimmy Fallon have thrown the category some real Drag Race-level shade.
They don't have writers and they don't have plots.
They're the only thing on TV that people still watch.
Reality!
When the Emmys started happening for reality shows, it literally felt like the prom and you got to get invited and all the cool kids didn't really want you there. And I don't know if that feeling is totally gone.
That's Todd Lubin, a co-founder of Matador Content, where they make dozens and dozens and dozens of reality shows. I asked him why producers would even want to be in a club that doesn't really want them as a member. Turns out, part of the reason is peak TV.
But look, you know, it's a marketing tool. And I think more than anything, the simplest answer, right, is there's so much out there now that anything that can identify you as something unique and different is probably the most important thing you can have.
But aren't the Emmys supposed to be all about celebrating quality and watching Veep win again? Well, yes, but that's not always how the game is played. Heather Schuster has been both a buyer and supplier of reality TV shows. She says Emmy wins are driven by network campaigns, which are sometimes about their best shows and sometimes about their most important talent.
For a lot of reality shows, the talent really wants an Emmy. And, you know, I think that will fuel or drive whether a network is willing to put money behind an Emmy campaign.
Sarah Mass started making reality TV shows back in the 2000s, working on series like Wife Swap and Super Nanny. Now an executive producer of her own show, she says no one sets out thinking they're going to win an Emmy. And yet...
I mean, there's sort of a joke in the room that you say, you know, I smell Emmy. So I think we all leave every meeting, you know, tossing that as we go out the door, hoping that someone believes us.
But how do you get from smelling it to seeing it? Let me rephrase. If you were going to create a reality TV show that was perfect Emmy bait, like Oscar bait, but for TV, what would be the right mix of elements to ensure a trip down the red carpet?
I think it's a world that we haven't seen.
It's really hard to find that culture that has not been sort of like uncovered.
Diversity, yet humor.
The Amish, the last great frontier.
Adventure race around the world. Starring drag queens.
So I would say it would be a true crime show who enjoy making fantastic food in a competitive environment and perhaps also sing.
Easy, right? I mean, everything is easy through the magic of radio. What happens when seven Amish drag queens...
You wear that bonnet, Machen. Don't let the bonnet wear you.
...and a United Nations team investigating human rights abuses in Yemen... all move in to a karaoke bake shop.
Gosh darn it, my fingers!
It's Rumspringa on the Arabian Peninsula, where anything could happen, so long as it's in keeping with local customs and traditions. Variety raves, the hooks and eyes have it. Entertainment Weekly, which is now published monthly, says, okay, guess this is next. And one of those hundreds of NPR podcast enthuses, only mildly offensive, but insightful into the current state of the Middle East and the ongoing geopolitical stalemate. It's Amish Drag Bake Off International. Tighten your religious head coverings. It's going to be a bumpy 12 to 14 episodes. This fall on Fox, or maybe Bravo, A&E, or that new HBO Plus thing.
Where's my buggy?
The Bonnets are on it. For The Frame, at least until this pile of genius content sells, I'm Colin Friesen.
And that is it for The Frame Emmy Special. The show was edited and produced by Darby Maloney and Jonathan Shiflett. Producers also included Robert Garova, Julia Paskin, and Andrea Gutierrez. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza, and I'm John Horn. When not in awards mode, we have a daily and weekend show, and you can find The Frame wherever you listen to podcasts. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC in Los Angeles, that's it for us, but not for the Emmys. Enjoy them on Sunday night.